All right, members, we're going to begin. Today's hearing will be a joint hearing between the, or with, the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee. And we have Chair Pinto here. And so he and I will be chairing this committee hearing together. Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform, as well as our Early Childhood Finance and Policy. So I hereby call this meeting to order, and I'll ask the clerk to take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Present.
Chair Pinto.
Present.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Present.
Vice Chair Pryor.
Present.
Lead Franson. Lead Franson.
I believe that she's excused, Mr. Abdullahi.
Lee Johnson.
Present.
Representative Bennett.
Present.
Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Daniels.
Present.
Representative Dabney.
Dabney, present.
Representative Daymuth.
Present.
Representative Edelson.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Grossel.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hewitt.
Present.
Representative Juergens.
Juergens, present.
Representative Cleavorne.
Cleavorne, present.
Representative Katiza Watun. Representative Katiza Watun. Representative Long. Representative Long. Representative Lucero.
Good morning.
Representative Morrison.
Morrison, present.
Representative Mueller.
Mueller, present.
Representative Novotny.
Novotny, present.
Representative O'Neill.
O'Neill, present.
Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, present.
Representative Vang.
Vang, present.
Representative Wazlawick. Representative Wazlawick. Representative Walgamott. Representative Walgamott. Representative Shung.
Present.
Wazlawick is present. I'm in another committee chairing. Sorry about that.
Representative Katiza Watun. Representative Long. Representative Walgamott. And that concludes roll call. Chairs, a quorum is present.
Very well. A quorum is present. Just to give the quick disclaimer here, this joint hearing is being held under Minnesota House Rule 10.01, allowing for hearings to be held via use distance voting, remote electronic voting, or voting by other means, although there will be no voting in this joint hearing today. To protect the health and safety of the public, staff, and members, the hearing is streamlined on our respective House, or rather on our House website, and can be accessed on our respective committee pages. And those who are wishing to offer testimony under House Rule 10.01 can contact either one of our committee administrators. In this committee, it's Committee Administrator Jamal Lundy, this committee meaning the Public Safety Committee. And we ask for folks to contact us 24 hours prior to the hearing. Members, I'm going to ask Representative Pinto to begin us and guide us through the first part of this hearing. This joint hearing, it gives us an opportunity to look at the incredibly important overlaps of early childhood investments and their impact on public safety. As I see Representative Juergens with us, he and I have not served on a committee together, unfortunately. However, a few years ago, Representative Juergens graciously hosted me out in his district where we visited some K-12 or elementary schools That same day, he visited that elementary school in my district. And I mention that because it seems to me that when it comes to the work, important work that we do as a society in terms of guiding and helping to equip and develop the capacity and the citizenship capacity in particular of our young people, it always seems to come to the fore just the incredible overlaps of all our policy impacts on young people, how important it is for us to understand those and coordinate them with one another. And so today, I think, will be, a hearing held in that spirit of understanding these incredible overlaps. So before I turn it over to Representative Pinto, I do note that Representative Juergens has raised his hand. Representative Juergens, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Charity. Thanks for mentioning that. I enjoyed visiting the West Side School of Excellence in your district and appreciate you coming to Hastings. But I do also wanted to point out, I believe we served on the Education Finance Committee my first term together. So we have been on a committee together in the past.
Oh, good. I'm remembering now. Good. All right, boy, that goes back a few years now. Well, it's good to see you, Representative Juergens. All right, very well, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks, members, so much. I do want to note that Representative Wolgamott is now on for our clerks to please take note of that. And I am just so thrilled to have this hearing today. And thank you, Chair Mariani, for joining together. And members and staff, a particular thank you to you all and a bit of an apology because I know this could not be a busier time in session. And so I know that we are squeezing this in. And it may not have occurred to many folks about the intersection between these two committees. But as the Chair Mariani said, I think if we think about community safety, we recognize that our policies relating to young kids could not have a bigger impact in the long term on public safety and community safety. And I think that we know that in our gut when it comes to kids, even as young as elementary school. And I hope over the course of the next little bit, we'll have that sense that, in fact, it's even more true as we go younger. We have a terrific set of testifiers with us. And so I'm going to move on to get that started. And just note, when we have a virtual format, we can have folks from all over the country join us, of course. We have a national expert joining us who happens to be living in Minnesota, Dr. Megan Gunner from the University of Minnesota. And when I travel around the country to work on early childhood policy, she is regularly cited by colleagues all over. So we're lucky to have her to kind of lay the foundation for us in understanding the connection between these two topics and getting us started. So Dr. Gunner, if you can identify yourself further and then please proceed.
Well, thank you, Chair Pinto and Chair Mariani. I'm really very honored to be here today. I need to share my screen and make sure I do this correctly. This is always the anxiety provoking time, right?
Indeed, often a challenge. We'll see if we can.
Often a challenge. And so yet, you can see me? My screen.
Yeah, you probably want to do the show slideshow
function. Yeah, I got it.
Oh, look at that. You're all good. Okay.
So I'm really delighted to be here today to talk about what we know about early childhood experience, brain architecture, and how they link to ultimately to public safety. I'm a part of something called the National Scientific Council on the Developing Child, which is developmentalists and neuroscientists that have come together to really figure out what we do know and then try to package it in a way that will help policymakers like you to understand where the science of early childhood is at. And we know from decades of research, we know that we've got to, make this go down, from decades of research that the foundations of a successful society is built in early childhood. It's based on healthy child development. These then allow us to form those pillars of educational achievement, economic productivity, responsible citizenship, which is what you're especially interested here today, and increasingly we're understanding lifelong health. That helps bring build strong communities, a healthy economy, and critically important, the successful parenting of the next generation, because we have a two-generation, three-generation issue when it comes to needing to support early childhood. Now, part of this National Scientific Council, we've put together some videos that are much more interesting than listening to us talk. So I'm going to, this is a very short one. It's 2 minutes, and I think it will give you the strong sense of why early childhood development is so important. So
Dr. Gunner, just to pause for a second, there's a sort of a black box at the top of your slide. I'm not sure if you can see
that. Yeah, I don't know how to get rid of that.
Okay, you're seeing that in your own screen. Okay. Well, we may just need to, oh, wait a second. Now we have more black boxes. And you're muted, just to warn you. Okay. Well,
okay. Is that better?
There you go. There's still one near the bottom.
I can't get rid of it. But
during the earliest years of life have a lasting impact on the architecture of the developing brain. Genes provide the basic blueprint, but experiences shape the process that determines whether a child's brain will provide a strong or weak foundation for all future learning, behavior, and health. During this important period of brain development, billions of brain cells called neurons send electrical signals to communicate with each other. These connections form circuits that become the basic foundation of brain architecture. Circuits and connections proliferate at a rapid pace and are reinforced through repeated use. Our experiences and environment dictate which circuits and connections get more use. Connections that are used more grow stronger and more permanent. Meanwhile, connections that are used less fade away through a normal process called pruning. Well-used circuits create lightning-fast pathways for neural signals to travel across regions of the brain. Simple circuits form first, providing a foundation for more complex circuits to build on later. Through this process, neurons form strong circuits and connections for emotions, motor skills, behavioral control, logic, language, and memory during the early critical period of development. With repeated use, these circuits become more efficient and connect to other areas of the brain more rapidly. While they originate in specific areas of the brain, the circuits are interconnected. You can't have one type of skill without the others to support it. Like building a house, everything is connected, and what comes first forms a foundation for all that comes later.
So, this little video, I think, makes it pretty clear that what neuroscience has shown us is that experiences are, positive experiences are important for developing a healthy brain. In fact, the brain becomes what the brain thinks about. And you have to wonder what nature was thinking, because we are born one of the most helpless mammals on the planet. And for many, many months, there's no way a baby can provide itself with the stimulation it needs to develop a healthy brain and strong brain architecture. Well, what nature was thinking is we have evolved, in essence, to develop in the context of relationships. Our brain is designed to develop in the context of relationships with parents and with the other important adults in the child's life, grandparents, brothers and sisters, and teachers. Our relationships provide the stimulation the baby needs in order to form that healthy brain architecture. And what we've discovered, the essence of that is something that we can think of as serve and return kind of interactions. The baby serves, and that means looks at the parent, for example, and that requires that they send a nerve signal. And when the parent or the grandparent or the teacher responds to that signal, literally glial cells in the brain come and nurture and feed that connection to help make it get stronger. So these serve and return interactions build that brain architecture and allow the baby, in a sense, to guide its own curriculum. I'm interested in this today. I'm interested in that tomorrow. These serve and return relationships form the basis of security. So secure serve and return interactions support the development of secure relationships with parents and with the other important people in that child's life. Now, this pattern of serve and return and secure relationships turns out to form the foundation of the development of responsible adolescents. There's a long pathway. There are at least two, and they're very interconnected, and nothing is certain. It's all of tipping the odds. But what we know from many years of research is those serve and return safe relationships are actually an expression of the fact that the adult in the child's life respects them and respects the choices that they may want to make. And as the child gets older, there's support for that child's autonomy. And it's the kind of support where you are given choices between two acceptable alternatives, right? So do you want to wear the blue shirt today or the yellow shirt today? We are beginning to understand that that very process of allowing children to make choices means it puts their brain into a reflective mode. They have to think about, do I want this or this? Reflection helps build something called executive functions. Executive functions require our really beautiful prefrontal cortex, and executive functions are what will allow us to make good choices, to stop, to think, to plan, and to do. And developing executive functions in the prefrontal cortex, which takes from about year one through about age 25, it takes a long time for us to really develop the capacity to control ourselves, begins early in development with the initial opportunity to reflect and make decisions and make appropriate choices. The other pathway is that if a child is safe and secure with the adults around them, they want to be like those adults around them. And we call this committed compliance. They want to imitate and do what we do. Now, that in and of itself will not make a child who is going to be a responsible adult. But if we combine that with what we call authoritative parenting, and I'm sorry about this little black box, I'll move it around a little bit. Authoritative parenting, which is explaining why children are being asked to follow a particular rule, why that rule is important. And with development, as children are capable, bringing them into helping to set up the family rule process and discuss rules and so on. These two pathways, which are interlinked, we know are terribly important for supporting the development of teenagers and adults who make good choices, mostly. Okay. Whoops, I moved that. Now I have to come back here. While families are an important place where this happens, these kinds of supports for autonomy, executive functions, and so on also can happen and do happen in high-quality educational settings. And terribly important for these pathways, especially early on as you're beginning to set up that basic architecture, but important all the way through. We can't, but begins early in life. What can derail this process? Well, what can derail it very profoundly is toxic stress, or what we can talk about as chronic stress activation. Stress triggers an alarm response. That alarm response in our brain stimulates the production of stress hormones. Those hormones, cortisol, epinephrine, others, change the way the body and the brain are working, and actually will change the development of the brain in young children. Okay, sorry. What that alarm reaction does is it takes off, it changes us from, I wish I knew how to get rid of this guy, so sorry. From a reasoning brain, which is governed by our prefrontal cortex and reality testing and top-down thinking and so on, to it takes that whole prefrontal cortex offline. You just can't use it. And what happens is you the reactive centers of your brain, your emotional centers, take over, and we kick into a habit way of responding. And we've all experienced this when we're under stress. We just don't reason as well, and we're more likely to say and do things that we think, oh, why did I do that? And it was emotionally charged. This happens to adults, and it happens to children as well. With adults, though, hopefully for you and I, when that happens, we have a well-developed prefrontal cortex. If it happens a lot of trauma, it can actually weaken that cortex. But for children, they are developing that prefrontal cortex. And so this kicking in of a stress response can literally derail the development of a thinking and reasoning brain and move us from a brain that is reflective to one that acts now and thinks later and makes a lot of bad decisions. Because they're operating on a more emotional realm. Parents are critically important for scaffolding the development of that beautiful reflective brain that can self-regulate. But parents are also open. Adults around the children are also open to the same effect, that stressors will take their prefrontal cortex offline, weaken their prefrontal cortex, and lead them to respond habitually. And we know what the stressors are in young families. Their problems with finances, their problems with relationships, their problems with job loss. There's problems like children themselves are very stressful. There's problems with the mental and emotional issues for the parents. When we see these things happening to parents and their prefrontal cortex comes offline and they're responding more emotionally, we see more harsh parenting, more frightening behavior, more parent fighting, interparental violence, and low levels of serve and return. So these are the conditions that derail that beautiful pattern that I showed you before of developing responsible young people. What can we do? I'm going to learn how to get rid of this thing. What we can do is what you all are working on, thinking of laws and policies that create stability, not disruption for families, working on early interventions for families at risk, including home visiting programs and others, high quality early education programs that begin in infancy, especially for high risk families where the child maybe needs that outside support, especially to begin to develop those strong circuits, and mental health and substance abuse services available to all families. Again, if we can get these in place, we have the makings of a successful society, which we can build beginning in early childhood. Thank you very much for your attention. And if you're interested, here are some more places where you can get information.
Dr. Gunter, thank you so much. And I should note that every one of those slides has, I know, so much research and detailed information behind it. And so we're so grateful to you, and hopefully you can stick around for a bit for questions. Wonderful. Turning to Andre Dukes and members, I'm thinking we'll make our way through these presentations would be the goal. If there are clarifying questions, we could have those quickly, but otherwise we'll have some time for Q&A after we make it through the next few testifiers. So we have Andre Dukes, I believe, with us. Mr. Yes. Dukes, if you can identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Chair Pinto and Chair Mariani and the committee. Good morning to everyone. My name is Andre Dukes. I am the Vice President of Family and Community Impact for the Northside Achievement Zone. Our mission is to end multi-generational poverty and build a culture of achievement in North Minneapolis, where all low-income children of color graduate from high school, college, and career ready. We accomplish this through collaboration with parents, community organizations, and schools. Our goal is to disrupt the cradle-to-prison pipeline by developing a cradle-to-college pipeline. And we do this by partnering with families to provide early interventions and supports at each stage of the child's development. Part of our program includes Family Academy, which is a series of parent education classes that we offer to parents that are age-specific to the child. Recently, I developed a curriculum geared towards fathers, in particular called Proud Papa, which focuses on the impact of fathers the impact that they have on child development and the family system. We take a reflective approach to highlighting the ways fathers can make meaningful contributions to the lives of their children in partnership with the mother when possible. We are discovering that there are more single dads that are showing up to our classes, which is interesting, and many of them have challenges and barriers that they are trying to overcome within a co-parenting relationship, but also in terms of employment and past incarceration. These fathers are committed to their children, and many report becoming a father as the turning point for their lives. We talk about the reciprocal benefit of the relationship they share with their children and the changes that have taken place within them as a result of spending time with their children. There was a study out of the University of Oxford in 2011 by Dr. Lee Gettler that shows there are both hormonal and brain changes that happen within first-time dads. And so our dads support these findings when they describe the connections they feel to their children and their desire to be better men for the sake of themselves and their children. They report less of a desire to engage in unlawful activity and are calmer and less stressed when interacting with their children. They are more happy and playful and report being more motivated to achieve goals around education, employment, and housing. And so I think the bottom line here is that, you know, when fathers are engaged with their children, they just feel more of a responsibility to themselves and to their children to not be engaged in criminal activity or in things that are not directly contributing to the well-being of that child. And then in them, they feel more motivation to do better for themselves, to be more educated, to get employment, and those kinds of things. And, you know, what we understand is that fathers develop a very important bond with children when they are engaged early and when there are separations that does have a long-term effect on children, depending on the length of time that the child is separated from the father and the circumstances around that separation. And so I think this is a very important bill to support fathers in particular and their ability to continue to contribute to the family system. And so thank you so much for your time, and I'm open to any questions at the end.
Thank you, Mr. Dukes, and thanks so much for your important work in our community. So glad to have you here. And then we have Sheriff Tim Leslie is the next testifier. Just two more testifiers members, and then we'll have some time for our questions and discussion. So Sheriff Leslie, we have you, I think, if you can identify yourself and proceed.
Yeah, hi, it's Jim Leslie. I'm the sheriff of Dakota County, representing the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. I want to thank both Chairs Mariani and Pinto for allowing me the opportunity to speak today. And I want to thank Mr. Dukes. Oh, my gosh, the work you do. Unbelievable. Thank you, sir, for everything you do. I'm a big supporter of Fight Crime, Invest in Kids. I've been so, as well as the Minnesota Sheriff's Association has been. So I'm testifying on behalf of them and the Minnesota Sheriff's. This is a pay me now or pay me later proposition. I work in the pay me later field. One of the responsibilities of sheriffs that you probably all are aware of is we manage jails. Yeah, and so I have a 263-bed jail in Dakota County, and it costs our taxpayers of Dakota County $14 million to maintain and operate that jail every year. I'm probably the fifth largest jail, maybe the sixth largest jail. So you can imagine and do your math homework on that, because we got 87 of them. We offer 24/7 nursing, mental health counseling. We assist with addiction recovery as people come down from their addictions. It's quite the operation. And some members of this committee and other members of the House of Representatives and Senate have been to the Dakota County Jail and have seen the operation. I would highly suggest that. As a way to see the people, the human beings that are coming across the thresholds of our jails. And it's just it's a good way to see what we really face. I believe in this as an investment upstream towards proven methods that work. It's been outlined in the documents that was sent to the committee. We can reduce future incarceration of our youth. We can increase high school graduation and employment. It's a great strategy, and it's supported by law enforcement. Some of you may be aware that I've chosen not to seek re-election in the fall. And one of the reasons are my two grandchildren. They're 4 years and 2 years respectively. Watching them learn, reading them books, exploring new things together is a main reason for my stepping away from this job. My spouse, Julie, is an educator and a former preschool director. And we just love being with those two little boys. All kids need the stimulation and opportunity to learn. Please support additional funding for high quality early childhood education for all, but especially towards those kids for no fault of their own live in poverty. And I want to say thank you to that.
Thank you so much, Sheriff Leslie, to your work, for your work. And I should note, members, that there is a that these two testifiers, both Sheriff Leslie and Chief Adam about to speak, are with an organization called Fight Crime, Invest in Kids, which is a national organization, but with many Minnesota members. And we're getting a letter posted to the committee websites that is from that national organization, signed by many Minnesota law enforcement leaders. So with that, Chief Adam, you're up next. Pleasure to have you. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Mariani, Chair Pinto, and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Marissa Adam. I'm the Chief of Police in Thief River Falls, Minnesota. Like Sheriff Leslie, I'm also a member of Fight Crime, Invest in Kids, a national anti-crime group of 5,000 law enforcement executives who take a hard-nosed look at the research about what keeps kids on a path to productive, successful lives. I'm here to make the case that early childhood care and learning programs impact not just success of our young children, but also the next generation of law enforcement leaders like myself. These leaders will be set up to fail if Minnesota does not invest in evidence-based programs that reduce crime by preventing young people from coming into contact with the criminal justice system in the first place. As it stands, our state faces some monumental challenges. On the public safety front, we are facing high rates of criminal activity. According to data from 2019, there was more than 13,000 violent crimes and 117,000 property crimes committed in Minnesota just that year. And the incarceration and pre-release services budget is set at $460 million per year. On the education front, too many children are failing behind before they enter school and often perform poorly in their subsequent K through 12 years. In fact, more than half of Minnesota eighth graders are not proficient in math, nearly two-thirds are not proficient in reading, and 16% of students are not graduating from high school on time. Thankfully, we know that there are investments that would help address both of these issues. Kids who are prepared to learn by the time they enter kindergarten have greater academic success and better behavioral outcomes in their later school years. Additionally, studies have found direct links between quality early childhood education and crime reduction, and with remarkable results. For example, children who did not participate in the Chicago Parent Childhood Centers program were 70% more likely to be arrested for a violent crime by age 18. By age 24, participants were 20% less likely to have served time in jail or prison. Lack of investment comes at a human price and at an economic price too. Cost-benefit analysis of early education programs have demonstrated a large positive return on investment, including through savings realized from crime reduction. But Minnesota parents still struggle to access and afford these programs, much less high quality programs. I do know here in the Thief River, and speaking with the director of our Head Start program, that we have at least 250 children that need child care in our small city up here in Northwest Minnesota. Also, our Head Start program here is for low income housing persons, which I've been told lets a lot of families and children fall through the cracks because they might have a job for maybe a year, maybe not a great paying job, so they cannot get into the Head Start program. They have to go to our preschool program at our elementary school, which costs money for young children. You know, it can only be half days, so that means they also have to pay for childcare. So those are just a few things locally here that we're dealing with. Of course, you know, the lack of providers for childcare is huge right now for us. Even childcare that can be, you know, after 5 p.m. because we have businesses here that, that do run 24/7. It's hard to find childcare for those students. With a more than $9 billion state budget surplus this year, we are in a unique position to invest in young children, meet the needs of working families, and enhance Minnesota's public safety. As law enforcement community knows, we cannot simply arrest and incarcerate our way out of the problem. When we invest in early learning programs, we put children in the state on a path for greater safety and prosperity. Thank you again to the committee members and chairs for your time and consideration today.
Thank you so much, Chief Adam, for your work and for your testimony. And members, as we turn to discussion and question about this sort of first half of our hearing, I'll just note again that there is a letter signed by, I think it's more than 40 law enforcement leaders around Minnesota, being posted to our committee website, and also a research report that was released today on the link between investing in high quality early learning and public safety outcomes in Minnesota, so specific to Minnesota. So are there member questions or comments on the topics that have been raised thus far? Let's see if there are. Chair Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank Chief Adam for her comments. She drew out a little beyond the lifespan focus of this Early Childhood Committee into the importance of after-school programming and out-of-school programming, which we know kids who are busy, positively engaged, and building relationships with other adults outside of their immediate family do better on a life cycle basis. Last year, if my memory serves, the governor was able to appropriate $5 million to Ignite Minnesota, the after-school programming advocacy group and support organization for after-school and out-of-school time organizations, specifically to try to fill some of that need in the state. I look forward to continuing to work in that space this year because of the value that Chief Adam identified. Keep kids positively engaged, developing, exploring their interests, and building relationships with each other and with concerned and caring adults is a strategy for child development. It's also a strategy, as she expressed so well, for public safety. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much, Chair Dabney. Representative Pryor, over to you. Oh, we got to get you. Hold on. Get you unmuted.
Try again. Thanks. All right. So thanks, Chair Pinto. Thanks, Chair Mariani, for hosting this morning. And I did want to come on and say congratulations to Mr. Leslie for his grandchildren. I'm thinking that someday they're going to do the study and find that your brain changes when you become a grandparent. and that it changes for the better and forever after that. So thanks for that. Congratulations on that step in life. And I'm sure it was a difficult decision to not run for re-election. And I actually honestly can say I think I ran for re-election when I became a grandparent and realized I really cared about our future because I saw it. I was holding it in my arms. And it's not just how well my grandkids did, but how all of our grandkids do and all of our children do. So thank you very much for speaking out today and appreciate the work of our testifiers.
Thank you so much, Vice Chair Pryor. Representative Mueller was up next.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. I think I'm kind of in a unique position right now in the sense that I'm also on education finance and education policy. And on public safety. So to hear this has been kind of a really interesting intersect of what's happening here. But I just really, really appreciated Ms. Gunner's presentation. I have done for the last 20 years as a teacher, I have been in now this term completing my doctorate in education. I've seen just how important it is that what she was talking about, how we have these foundations and how they affect the kiddos that I get. And I get I taught 8th and 10th grade for a long, long time. And you can tell those who have those solid foundations. But what I really appreciated the most was when she talked about how we have the pattern and supporting choices for our students. And I just love that because this is such a strong argument for making sure that our students have choices in education. And I don't necessarily just mean education choice. I mean, how are we able to make public school and private school, how are we able to make it so that we are able to have many experiences count and that they're able to kind of follow in places that they're interested in and that they're gifted in and that we're able to look at how school can look differently in the future. So thank you, Ms. Gunner, for your presentation. And I'm really excited that we have this presentation today. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Mueller. Thanks so much. Representative Hewitt, you're up next.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, and thank you, Chair Mariani, for hosting today. I can't let this day pass without my feelings for Sheriff Leslie there. In my earliest days as a elected official, he called me in. We talked. This is one of the subjects that we talked about. He might not remember that. But he has always been an advocate for all Dakota County, but many of you probably don't know that he started out as a beat cop for St. Paul. And this is what I'm going to miss when he moves on, and I really have to thank him not only as an elected official that he's really been great counsel and part of the team on, but also for Dakota County. We're really going to have a void there, but I'm sure his predecessor will look at programs like this and keep it going. So thank you, Sheriff Leslie.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. I've had the chance to work with Sheriff Leslie for the years and my work as a prosecutor actually before on this role, and just so much, so grateful to him as well, Representative Hewitt. So thank you for shining a light on that. I think Representative Katiza Watoon had her hand up next, and then Representative Juergen. So Representative Katiza Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to both our chairs here for hosting this meeting today. And we've in the Early Childhood Committee, we've had such a great opportunity to really learn a little bit more about how our work coincides with the work of the other committees in the House this year. And I really want to express my gratitude for that. This is always a really challenging hearing for me to listen to. For those of you who don't know, I'm a former foster parent, and my children came home to us at the ages of 2, 3, and 4 after having a number of traumas happen in their early lives. And I think it's so important that when we talk about early intervention, that we really keep this in mind. I mean, for children who are living in out of home placement, they if nothing else but the separation from their biological parents has occurred to them in those first few years of their life, that is such a difficult experience for them to go to, not even having had the opportunity to develop that first bond. Biological parent-child bond. So it does take a lot of work for us to kind of patch over some of those connections, some of the brain development that Dr. Gunner spoke about that hasn't happened. And I really want to express my gratitude for all of our colleagues in the legislature who continue to push ahead with making sure, like Representative Miller talked about, making sure that our kids do have options. So when we increase our funding for schools and make sure that there are social workers available, when we increase the funding for after school programs like Representative Dabney talked about, and make sure that our kids have safe places to go, they have reliable, trusting, caring adults outside of their family members in their life, all of those things can make a huge difference. I had a hearing earlier this week in Commerce about funding for the Automobile Theft Prevention Fund. And we had a testifier, Sheriff Bob Fletcher, Ramsey County, and he talked about how the increase in crime that we're seeing across the cities and across the state and across the country, has a disproportionate amount of 13, 14, 15-year-olds. Who are committing some of these crimes. And I can't help but think that there's so much of a difference that we can make in the lives of these children to kind of keep them hopefully on the right track, as Dr. Gunner spoke about. And I think that could be just so impactful when we make the decisions that we have the power to make here at the legislature, that it could really transform the lives of an individual child, but also the children and families across the state of Minnesota. So, Mr. Chair, I just want to again say thank you for this, and really trying to help put our brains in the right focus for the next couple of weeks, as we're going to be making some very critical funding decisions that could change the future of the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Katiza-Watoon. Yeah, we are trying to sort of lay some brain pathways here for our members of these committees, just like happens in early life. Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And at the risk of piling on and embarrassing the sheriff, I want to echo the comments made by Representative Hewitt. Dakota County Sheriff Tim Leslie has been just fabulous to work with in my 6 years in the House. Tim, you've been there to answer questions for me, to offer advice. You helped me set up ride-alongs with your deputies. In fact, right behind me, I have patches from the different departments I've ridden with, and prominent right in there is the Dakota County Sheriff's Department. Sheriff, you were instrumental in getting the Smart Center, which has been just a key for improving the resources that your deputies, that your department has. And I wish you the best. You've earned it, but you are definitely going to be missed. And it was nice to see you on here this morning, Tim. So thank you for all that you've done, and good luck.
You're muted, Chair.
Thank you so much, Chair Mariani, and thank you, Representative Juergens. Chair Mariani, if you want to jump to the front of the line, I would grab you, but otherwise I'll work through some of the other members first. Is that okay with you, Chair?
Mr. Chair, I'll wait for the others, absolutely.
Okay. So I saw Representative Morrison's hand up next. We do have quite a few folks. I'll just ask people to keep things fairly brief if they can, but want to get everybody in. So Representative Morrison, you're up next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will be brief. I just want to thank our chairs for convening this important meeting, this important hearing this morning. I think it's not always immediately obvious the connection between public safety and early childhood, so I just appreciate both of you for highlighting that. I wish we could broadcast this hearing across the airwaves. I think our testifiers did such a fantastic job explaining the connection and the importance of investing in early childhood. Dr. Gunner, I wrote down one of her quotes. She always is so wonderful to hear. She said, "We've known for decades, we have decades of research, that the foundations of a successful society are built in early childhood." So I just hope that this hearing provides inspiration for us to really double down on the importance and the need to invest in early childhood, so that every young Minnesotan has the best opportunity to have a healthy life and have every opportunity in front of them. So just a lot of gratitude to the chairs and to our testifiers today.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. I think Representative Damuth was up next, and then Representative O'Neill. Representative Damuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to also thank the testifiers for bringing their points and their areas of expertise out so clearly. To Mr. Dukes, the idea of the Family Academy was very impressive to me, and how that can change from that point. To Dr. Gunner, again, some of those things that we have heard in the areas of early brain development, that genetic component, but then the experiences that come with this. And then to our law enforcement officers that see so many things, what could be done, but also the end result of what happens when it's not done well. I too want to thank both of the chairs for bringing these committees together. And as we work forward for solutions, I think it's going to take all of us. It's going to take all areas and how we can improve things, both for families generationally, but for some of those littlest ones. So I just wanted to make those comments, Mr. Chair. Thanks to all of the testifiers for bringing your expertise to us.
Thank you, Representative Damuth. And I'll just note, those some of us had heard Dr. Gunner before, what was somewhat new to me was the connection of adolescence and beyond, which is so critical for public safety. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. I just wanted to kind of bring into the conversation places like Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge and others that do this incredible work. And the reason I bring them up is that they focus so much on restoring the parent, and then they do family therapy. They try to reintegrate the family together and literally do the parenting classes that we just talked about here, where they are really engaging and teaching them like how to reengage with their own children. Because of course, when you have addiction and sometimes a dual diagnosis with a mental health disorder, that really separates that parent from the child. So there are lots of great organizations, but I used to work there, so I know intimately what they do. And they, you know, in the legislature, we do support their work. While they're a private nonprofit through some GRE fund, or yeah, not GRE, DRH funding, through Health and Human Services, they get some funding from the state, which is super important. But there are others as well. There's also AVO that does, they have children with the parent, with the mother, that do treatment together. And so they relearn and kind of relink. So there are so many, you know, of course, that's where my brain is, because I'm in public safety. And I've done a lot of work in that realm. So these are also things that the legislature can support. And obviously the most important link is between the child and the parent. And Then it's probably extended family, maybe grandparents or aunts or uncles. And then we should look to others that can fill in the gap, like the former representative just said about being a foster parent or the previous person that just spoke. I think it was Katiz Batun, maybe. In any case, but we should always focus on trying to keep the children with the parents, but help the parents to live a better life and to be a better parent. So I appreciate that focus in particular from Mr. Dukes that had said that. That was really impactful from where he's doing his work. I really appreciated that. So I think that in that realm, that's really important for me personally.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. And I'll just highlight that so much of the work in early childhood, as you say, is really supporting the parent where there's that critical step. Parents often do need strong support, though. So we want to be thinking in our policies doing that. Thank you. Representative Cleburne, I was going to let have Chair Mariani close us out and then sort of transition to the next area. Did you have something quickly that you wanted to jump in with? And then I would transition to Chair Mariani. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. And I will just say, as a mediator who deals with adults in conflict, you can see that the results of that unresolved child conflict between parent and child often goes into the workplace. It often goes into society in a larger picture because of those unresolved conflicts or that feeling of inadequacy that sometimes happens in early childhood. But I also want to say as a former guardian for children in need of protection, the work that you've outlined in this bill and the testimony that we've heard is really critical to making sure that those connections are rebuilt and made so that the children and the parents both feel whole. I've yet to meet a parent, even those whose children are in need of protection, who got up in the morning and said, I don't want the best life for this child. They just don't have the skills, or they have trauma that they're dealing with themselves. So this is a wonderful way to help break that trauma cycle, and I really am glad to see the work that you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Representative Cleburne. So I'm turning things to Chair Mariani both to close out this section and then, if you wish, Chair, to move us into the next section, please.
Yeah, very well. Thank you, Chair Pinto. I too want to add my voice to well wishes and appreciation for Sheriff Leslie. I was surprised. I didn't know until just a few minutes ago. I'd like to say you'll be missed, but I won't be here either next year. So, but I suspect Chair Pinto and others will indeed miss you. And I just want to take an opportunity to thank you for your engagement with us over the years and your words of wisdom and your challenging for us. Hopefully we've listened carefully to you and have adjusted accordingly because that's the smart thing to do. So thank you. And also, Chief, thank you for your comments here today and more importantly for your work in your community of Thief River Falls. I was particularly taken by your sharing that, frankly, members, we're not going to be able to arrest and incarcerate ourselves out of criminal problems. Having said that, of course there will be arrests and there will be incarceration. That is part of our system, and there are good reasons for that. And so I want to make sure that folks are hearing it powerfully correctly, at least as I believe, which is that there are multiple things that we need to do and that they should be connected with one another. Ergo, the purpose of this meeting, this hearing, where we've got public safety having good sharing with proper science evidence-based information around interventions, preventions, and guiding. I think that the science is absolutely important. We learn more every year, as Representative O'Neill shared. I'm sure Teen Challenge has learned and adapted and grown and is also using good, strong science-based approaches with a heavy dose of just good humanity and common sense, and the two are not exclusive of one another. I actually have a quick question, and it's for Mr. Cook with Northside. Thank you for your testimony. I was really taken by the sharing that that work that helps men, fathers, be able to center and focus their purpose and their actions on their children forms a really powerful dynamic for good citizenship, for good community stewardship, for contributing to their families, their children, but also to their community. Several years ago, I visited my local elementary, and I was stunned to find out the percentage of students whose, and these were like very young, you know, first, second, third grade, the percent, I think it was like north of 40% of our students there, very low income, and 40% of them had a parent or two, but at least one parent involved in our corrections system. Huge challenge for the school because of all the collateral, you know, consequences and limitations that those families face. But it strikes me, as I heard your comments, that what we do in our corrections system, because there will be incarceration, there will be, you know, holding people accountable, you know, by having them, you know, go through our system. But but it strikes me that what we do in corrections can be and probably should be restorative and complementary and coordinated, collaborative with the work that you're doing. And I suspect that the issue isn't then that these young men are, none of them are in a correction system. It's about what's happening in their lives, even if they are in the corrections system. So maybe if you just sort of, you know, either reject or affirm or just comment quickly on that, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. And yes, I absolutely affirm what you just said. It is important not only to establish those connections, but even maintain those connections when there is incarceration. So as much as, you know, we can keep children engaged with the father, whether it's through writing letters, whether it's through FaceTime, phone calls, just making sure that that father can continue to have a presence in the life of that child has huge impacts and benefits for the child and for the family unit. So, yes, thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for your work, Mr. Duke. Duke's blessings to you and to your community of activists and champions there. Chair Pinto, I have tons of other questions, but I don't think I should do that. But I do want to ask a number of questions of Dr. Gutter, but I will just reach out to her to do that. And, you know, I will say this as I do prepare to leave the legislature that, you know, it does occur to me that as important as our individual, quote unquote, sometimes siloed work as committees, is that this kind of hearing process and engagement should probably become more the norm than what we can squeeze in between. We have such a big load here, and so I know it's logistically tough, but I think it yields a particularly rich conversation, and I'm really taken by the bipartisan, you know, expression of understanding and inquiry that it has also set up. So thank you for your suggestion to hold this joint hearing together. I do want to thank all the testifiers, Dr. Gunner, Mr. Dukes, Sheriff Leslie, and Chief Adam, as well as all our committee members for engaging.
Reminder, Mr. Chair, that we do have the second half of the hearing we've got to get to, too.
Yes, indeed. Oh, yeah.
So,
yep, I was trying to.
Good, just making sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you. I was just trying to see if you were on your toes, Chair Pinto, which you always are. So, members, we will then transition over to the second half of this hearing, consistent with the first, quite frankly. So I would certainly invite the testifiers, if they're able to stick around as well, and offer your thoughts as well as the committee conversation when we get to that. So, members, we're going to have an informational hearing on House File 4191, Chair Pinto's bill. And so without anything else, I'll just turn it over right back to you, Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just note, so this is really an example of what we've been hearing about in the first half of the hearing. Of course, the investments that we need to be making in early care and learning and early childhood more general are part of that. But House File 4191 members came to us in the governor's, came to the public safety members in the governor's budget proposal and would create a family support unit within DOC to support the connections and engagement of incarcerated individuals and their families. And Section 2 would support family communication and support for those connections. We heard about secure attachment. We heard about the importance of relationships in the first half of the hearing. This is a specific example and application of that. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll just turn to the testifiers, Commissioner Schnell, to describe the proposal more.
Very well. Commissioner Schnell, welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, members. Thank you for allowing me to speak to this bill and just provide some background. And I want to thank Chair Pinto for leading this on this important initiative of supporting families. We're truly grateful for this. And as a former police chief and now having the opportunity to serve in this role, just listening to the first half of this hearing, bringing these two committees together just makes so much sense. And I'm really grateful to see it and to be a part of it. I'd also like to acknowledge the Office of the Ombuds for Corrections, who produced an impactful report last year that regarding strengthening families that really helped us think about and forge some of this proposal. As Representative Pinto mentioned, this investment would fund the creation of this family support unit within the DOC and to improve connections between those who are incarcerated and their families. And it increases access to phone calls and video visits for families. And I'll talk about why that's important in a second. We all recognize, Chair members, that the importance of family ties. Today we oftentimes don't think about the times we reach to our phones today to send a text, especially in your long days now at the Capitol or in the hearings that you have of sending a note to a spouse, significant other, loved one, or saying goodnight to your kids on those days when hearings go long. But for Minnesotans who have a loved one that's incarcerated, it's far more challenging to check in and express that level of support. Incarceration, by its very nature, is isolating, and it separates individuals from families and communities, limiting a person's contact with the outside world. And as Chair Mariani pointed out, sometimes this is just the nature of what needs to happen, but oftentimes, we know that in order for us to succeed with our mission of helping those in our correctional facilities across the state do better and be better, we need to ultimately advance and promote pro-social connection, which is really the key to rehabilitation. As most of all of us have experienced over the last 2 years of the pandemic, has been really particularly difficult. The lack of human connection was, and in many cases remains, acutely painful for those who are incarcerated, as well as their kids and spouses and other family members. And we all know that having an incarcerated parent is itself an adverse childhood experience, one of the ACEs. And you heard a lot about this last year when we were discussing and you all passed the Healthy Start Act. But just as a reminder, on any given day in Minnesota, more than 16,000 children under the age of 18 have a parent who's incarcerated in one of the state's prisons, not to mention all county jails across the state. Today, you can see the many powerful letters from advocates on this bill, from the Sheriff's Association to the Children's Defense Fund. They highlight why these proposals are so important and why what makes them beneficial. And that is about maintaining strong family connections that ultimately creates better outcomes. Our goal is simple, and that is to increase family connection, and which we know contributes to public safety. That family connection and public safety are, in fact, one in the same. Research has consistently shown that family ties during incarceration significantly reduce the risk of reoffending. In fact, sustained family connection has been shown to reduce recidivism by as much as 56%. It's not surprising that our families are our moral compass. And I would just make one other point before I will show just a couple quick slides here. But connecting with the earlier presentation, the Department of Corrections has a different proposal that public safety has heard, talking about increasing educational opportunities, ultimately to build and strengthen Minnesota's workforce and help folks transitioning from incarceration into the community be more successful. And one of the things that we know, one of the elements of that we are interested in researching, we want to make sure that we can replicate it here, is that when incarcerated parents are involved in educational programs, it's been shown that their children in educational programs, regardless of age, do significantly better. This just makes good sense for the safety and good of Minnesota. Members, for a short summary of House File 4191, I have just a few slides that will show how this funding will help make more meaningful connections with the folks who are incarcerated and their loved ones. The bill ultimately creates this family support unit to ensure the work of supporting families and having that dedicated team at the DOC. Currently, the DOC has no liaisons for these families. We have one partner parenting coordinator who serves the entire 11 facility Department of Corrections. However, our staff and what we're hearing from those who are incarcerated is that having this would help families better navigate our systems and improve connections between those who are incarcerated and their families. This family support unit would include three new staff who are focused on helping families navigate the reality of having an incarcerated loved one and building and creating programming opportunities for families and having parental education programs. I should note that the single biggest program requested by both men and women who are incarcerated within DOC is parenting. And I think that's remarkable and speaks specifically to this proposal. The bill also invests in more opportunities for those connections to family to happen and increases the ability of kids and their and families to participate in video visits with their and phone calls with their loved ones. And as I mentioned, we know that this ultimately produces better outcomes for those people. Frequently, this is there is high cost with these communications. Nationally, families report spending over $300 per month to stay connected with a loved one who is incarcerated in prison, and one in three are forced into debt based on this. At the federal level, there has been bipartisan debate in Congress to limit the excessive cost of these calls. The bill called the Just and Reasonable Communications Act would permit the FCC to use traditional procedures and authority to address unjust and unreasonable rates for communications between those who are incarcerated and people on the outside. The bipartisan bill authors argue that the proposal enhances community safety and security by improving pro-social community connections between inmates and their family members, which is shown to reduce recidivism. However, we cannot wait for Congress to act. Minnesota can and should lead in this space. It builds upon the successful legislation that you passed last year in the Healthy Start Act, and we believe this would reduce recidivism, which right now, more than ever, as we see this spike in crime that all of us are concerned about, this type of investment makes sense. Chair and members, these requests are targeted at increasing opportunities for all to be engaged with those who are incarcerated and their loved ones. It increases the opportunity to create those positive connections, and we know that that ultimately will build a safer Minnesota. And with that, Chair, when you're ready, I would be happy to answer or stand for any questions you have.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you for your testimony, but also thank you for your work and your vision, your team and your colleagues' vision to work collaboratively to build this powerful proposal. We do have, Chair Pinto, another testifier, Glenn Powell. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah, I think it's just to speak real briefly, but yes, Glenn Palm.
Very well. Professor Palm, if you can come forward, state your name for the record and give us your testimony, we greatly appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Pinto and Chair Mariani and committee members for this opportunity to speak with you about my support of for House File 4191. My name is Glenn Palm, and I'm a professor emeritus of Child and Family Studies from St. Cloud State University. I've had the privilege of working as a parent educator at the St. Cloud Correctional Facility since 1995. In this role, I have taught hundreds of fathers. I remember the first day I went into the St. Cloud facility and met with Bruce Hansen, the education coordinator. He said, most people don't consider that inmates in our system get out and go back into their communities. This helped me to understand the important work that can and must happen inside and outside the prison walls to create safe communities. As I began my work at the St. Cloud facility, I interviewed men to learn about their interests and needs around parenting. I discovered that keeping contact with their kids was important to them. Separation from their children is difficult, and there are so many barriers to maintaining positive relationships. I asked the education coordinator, how many of the men in the facility were fathers? No one knew. Now we know that 2/3 of the men are fathers to minor children and that more than 70% of women are mothers. Research has documented, as people have said already this morning, the positive benefits for incarcerated parents. And in most cases, children also benefit from keeping contact during incarceration. This bill provides a correction system with staff dedicated to creating family support opportunities for incarcerated parents. The funds to support communication with children and family members is a critical component of this bill. I want to share a couple of lessons from my experience as a parent educator in the system. I discovered that most men in the St. Cloud facility care deeply about their children, but often were unable to express this care in positive ways. I interview each father before accepting them into my class. I listen to their stories of being at their child's birth, and I ask the question, what did it feel like to hold your baby for the first time? They emotionally melt as they describe it as life-changing, awesome, the best moment of my life. They feel their love at that moment as they recall this memory. A few moments later, I ask, who's your role model for being a good dad? And too many respond, no one. The second lesson is that most men want to learn to be good fathers. They don't often realize how much their children need, want, and deserve a good father. The ambiguous separation and loss that incarceration brings is hard on kids and hard on incarcerated parents and their co-parenting partners. I challenge men to write down an action every day during the 14-week class to show how they are working on being a good dad. Communicating from inside is not easy, but it is essential to keeping connected. This bill will help to take down some of the barriers. A third insight is that parent education and family support programs focus on two generations. When I offer a class for 20 men, I ask about the number and ages of their children, and in a typical class, there may be 50 plus children. This type of programming can have positive ripple effects on over 100 people. If we can create spaces that promote positive connections and healing of the adverse childhood experiences that men and women bring with them and pass on to their children, we can increase the capacity for men and fathers and mothers to transform themselves from risk factors to protective factors for their children when they go back into their families and communities. The promise of two-generation interventions is to decrease recidivism and interrupt the pipeline to prison for the next generation. Towards the end of class, I sit in a room and videotape dads reading books to their kids. I get the privilege to sit in that space with a father who loves his child and wants to connect as a good father. I get to see his best self. The bill provides a foundation for positive family connections and communication between parents inside and family outside. Combined with a network of proposed family supports outside the system, like giving priority to children of incarcerated parents for early childhood programs and home visiting programs, these become powerful intervention strategies. I want to end with a reflection on the cost of investing in family support and potential benefits. I'm often asked by colleagues if I've evaluated the parenting curriculum and is it evidence-based? Yes, I evaluate each group. It's required by the DOC. But the more important point is that if one of the 20 men in class does not reoffend and one of his children is diverted from entering the system, the payoff is huge compared to the investment. Thank you, and as my Elders for Infants colleagues say, invest earlier in children and families for the greatest impact. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Palm. Thank you for your work focused on evidence-based practices to decrease recidivism, create a diversion, a change of what the science tells us will happen if we don't work in these ways to affirm the restorative power within each individual to produce positive outcomes. It seems to me this is about strengthening our state and strengthening our people precisely through focusing on our families and the power that exists there. Thank you so much for your work. With that, members, we're going to open it up for questions, comments, discussion. I'll begin with Representative Poston.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. I have a question for Chair Pinto, and then after that, a quick question for Commissioner Schnell. Chair Pinto, I understand that this bill provides money for communications, but it also says related support services. Can you explain related support services to me?
Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Poston. I'm actually going to direct that, I think, to Commissioner Schnell or perhaps to his staff.
Commissioner Schnell.
Mr. Chair and Representative Poston, that is the family support part of this thing. So we want to make sure that there's a creation of connection as a part of this overall. So that's really some of the allied elements of this. And we have some required, there's some technical requirements that would be required in order to establish this. We do have people who are incarcerated who may not have contact with some of their children if they were offended against them. And so we have some of those dollars would help us to make sure we're managing the protection requirements that come along with this contact. You know, that is a relatively small number, but we do have that. We want to make sure that we are fulfilling that obligation to protect those children. So there are some costs with being able to having to manage that.
Representative Poston.
Commissioner, who may be approved as a support person?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Poston, that can be, it really would be primarily we're looking at family members. However, we do believe that, you know, for some people, family comes in a lot of different, I have a friend who does a lot of this work, talks about family with an F and family with a PH. And the family with the PH is really those people that if you don't have that mom and dad that you were connected with, but it may have been that neighbor, it may have been that old coach, whatever it was. We want to be able to make sure we're really evaluating who are the key and central supports for that individual. Obviously it's their parents, their significant other, their children, those become key. But if they don't have that, we want to make sure that there is some pathway to that pro-social contact.
Representative Poston.
Thank you, Commissioner. One last question. How many FTEs are we going to need in this new family support unit?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Poston, there's three FTEs in this family support unit.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Poston. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Schnell, I was going to ask about the three FTEs, and I know we have 11 prisons. So I'm not quite sure. First, when you said family support unit, I thought maybe you'd have one FTE per prison because then they could kind of coordinate with everybody. But how is that going to work? If we only have three FTEs in 11 prisons, where are they going to be located and how are they going to coordinate with the 11 prisons?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, you know, we came in with a reasonable ask going from really today having zero to three. What would happen is that the initial plan was to look at this as a regional kind of resource that would ultimately work, you know, the north more central, and we would divide the system up, which is a model that we've used in a number of other cases, and have those family support people work on the development of programs and using either existing staff or they themselves would help provide and develop curriculum, oftentimes based on things like the work of Dr. Pong around those family support curriculums that we can implement. And then we're also looking at some models where incarcerated folks themselves who may be in for a long time and have demonstrated a level of skill around this stuff, where we actually create, you know, peer training or education programs. So these folks would really be developing this as we kick this off across the state, and that's we're going to have to manage that. We want to really look at where the need, in particular, some of the larger facilities, is really where the heavy focus would be at the beginning.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. I'm kind of disappointed in that answer because I think if three people are developing curriculum, I'm pretty sure there's curriculum already out there in overabundance. I would think that this resource would be better used to actually coordinate prisoner and family connection and not stand up a new program where I'm sure there's plenty of curriculum out there that we could use. And I would just hope that if we're going to do this and we're going to develop this, that this is directly connecting the families with the incarcerated person, whether it's a woman or a man, or even at Red Wing with some of our juveniles. So I'm kind of disappointed in that answer, to be honest. I was really hoping that this was direct care staff and not more administration. So I'm disappointed. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner, not to drag Dr. Palm in, but just want to make sure that if he has something to add to this, but I do believe that the inquiry has to do with the design that the department is pursuing. Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, I appreciate that. I think that the reality is we have to do both. When we have today, the single biggest need that's been identified by those incarcerated is parenting programming. That is the number one requested program. We have to address that. But I don't disagree with you a bit, and we do expect that these positions will help facilitate those connections between families. One of the things that we did during COVID was we created family town hall meetings, and we had people, hundreds in some cases, people call in and be able to ask direct questions about, you know, what happens on the inside, different processes, ways that we could increase or improve connection between those family members. Address institutional barriers that were oftentimes a challenge. These are things that we believe these family support staff can provide on a regular basis for people to improve the connections across the board. So it's not a single use. It has to be a both and.
Very well. Lee Johnson.
Chair Mariani. Representative Pinto, understand the concept of this bill. I do have some questions for Commissioner Schnell. One thing we do have is on this program, are you doing any type of program like this already, or is this a new concept?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, Lee Johnson, we have, as was mentioned, at Shakopee, we do have a parenting coordinator there that works with the women. We do have some volunteer programs that come in and provide parent education, but we do not, by any stretch of the imagination, get close to meeting the need or the level of request for that. We oftentimes are pulling other staff that, you know, as a, for instance, during these large calls that we were putting together, where people were calling in, we would, you know, myself and other staff would be involved in those. And oftentimes, we were not necessarily the best people from an operational standpoint to answer some of the questions that they had. So we don't have this specifically, this parent family support positions exist today.
Lee Johnson.
Commissioner Snell, Chair Mariani, Commissioner Snell. With this program, is it going to be set up to make sure those that where the family member was actually a victim, are they going to do things to make sure that the perpetrator is not being able to contact them? Or is it going to try to reunificate them even though they were the victim?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Lee Johnson, as I mentioned, we take aggressive steps to ensure, and this includes monitoring and those sorts of things, to take steps to ensure that people who are incarcerated or where their victim is a family member, that there is a separation.
Lee Johnson.
Commissioner Saul, I sure hope you do that, because I have concerns on this. Because I've talked to some individuals working in the system already that have been doing this program. And the individual was very upset because he was forced to contact the victim, was the child of the perpetrator, and try to set up communications and work with that. The child was just out of control and had a lot of problems because of that. You just said you're not doing this yet. I'm hearing that this program is ongoing right now. It makes me wonder what's going on. So I think if we're going to do something like this before it starts, we need to make sure the guidelines are and all the policies are in place to make sure that these victims aren't going to be traumatized again because the state is contacting them to have contact with the perpetrator. It can be very traumatic for some of these victims. So until I actually get a good grip to what this program is and the guidelines and stuff's going on, I'm concerned on this because it needs to be very, make sure that we don't traumatize some of these victims again.
Commissioner, it seems you're nodding that you're sensitive to those concerns that are being raised.
Mr. Chair and Lee Johnson, I would just say that I will tell you that there are times because many of the people who are incarcerated are involved in family court processes, and there are oftentimes cases where there is facilitated or court-ordered required efforts that go on. And we do facilitate those calls in accordance with the court order and in accordance with county social services. So we, you know, just know that while we are concerned about that, there are other legal processes that we must comply with, court orders, and sometimes we do facilitate those types of visits through child protection services based in that county. But certainly we don't want to do anything to cause more harm. But there are times when the courts do order that we help facilitate those connections.
Very well. Representative Pinto, there's no other hands up, and so I'll have you close us out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks to Commissioner Schnell for his work and to Dr. Palm, who's been a partner here at Elder Shrinkfence for a long time. And I'll just note, Mr. Chair, and members, this has been a really good opportunity to collaborate across our two committees. I appreciate it, folks doing that. And I guess I'll perhaps cheekily just note that for those praising Sheriff Leslie, one great way to honor his work is to observe his guidance and those of the more than 40 other law enforcement leaders who've signed this letter saying that we should prioritize early childhood funding. Both generally speaking, and then certainly for those children who have incarcerated parents, I'm knowing that is such a particular risk factor, making sure that they have those strong connections. So I'm glad we've had this chance to collaborate today, Chair. I appreciate that, and thanks to all of you, and would urge support certainly for the bill that we've just heard. Thanks.
Lee Johnson, I see your hand back up.
Chair Mariani, I was going to have some comments as we close out the meeting, unless we can do that now.
Give me just a quick second. Commissioner, it strikes me that you and Sheriff Leslie probably overlapped in our St. Paul Police Department. Am I correct?
Mr. Chair, yes, Sheriff Leslie was at one point in time my boss at the St. Paul Police Department, and I had a better career because of him and his influence, and so I'm grateful to him as well.
Well, as am I. I thought that was the case. Very well. So we don't have the bill before us formally, but the bill is part of the governor's proposal, will be considered as we move toward constructing this committee's omnibus bill. I want to thank you, Chair Pinto, for presenting it with us today, and doing so in joint committee hearing. And I also want to express my gratitude to you, Dr. Palm, for your work in this important area. Greatly appreciate it. Lee Johnson, why don't you close us out then?
Thank you, Chair Mariani. I just have a couple questions. One, first of all, I was wondering if they were able to work out a in-person meeting next week as we wrap up the omnibus bill. I think it'd be good for members that have never actually, we have freshmen on this committee that have never actually sat in person in a committee to see how they actually operate. And I think it would be a good experience for them as we transition out of the committee process to the hurry up and wait on the floor process as we bring the bills forward. And so I just wondered if that is a possibility or not. I know Judiciary is on Thursday meeting in person over in Capitol 120.
Lee Johnson, I've had my staff working on that. I believe there's probably, I don't have details yet, which of our dates, but I know that my staff is preparing to do things like printing out lots of paper. It's a very good advice, and hopefully we can. I'm committed to doing it. It's just a matter of whether or not we can have it scheduled, with the House. But I believe that is going to happen. I'll keep it posted, and your members posted as well.
I appreciate that. One last thing as we close out. We know that targets have been out. I was just wondering if you'd be able to let us know what the target is for public safety as we move forward, so we have an idea what type of bills we're going to be having. If you were able to provide that information.
Yeah, Lee Johnson, that's fair. We will be posting the DE to the omnibus bill this weekend. If I can get it done tomorrow, I will, although we're really pressing staff pretty hard. I do want to do a shout out to our House research staff. As usual, we ask a lot of them. But my goal is to have that posted on Sunday. And my further goal is to be able to spend some time with you, if you're able to, over the weekend, to go over that with a little bit more detail.
I appreciate that. So,
very well. All right. Well, Chair Pinto, I think that wraps it up for us today. So I'm going to call that this joint hearing is adjourned. And rest up this weekend. It's going to be a busy week next week. This hearing is for my adjournment.